This is a recording of the Women's Recovery Meeting with the speakers Lori D. and Noreen J., recorded at the 3rd Annual 209 South Unity Day in Fresno, California, on Saturday, July 13, 1991. In observance with our 11th tradition, stating anonymity at the public level, please keep this tape within the fellowship and observe the anonymity of all NA speakers.
God, I hope so. My name is Noreen. I'm an addict. And it was a real surprise when I got here. I had been asked to come to this function and be the short speaker first thing in the morning. So I didn't even think about it. I thought I had 20 minutes. Shit, I can do 20 minutes with my eyes closed. And then I got up here, and when they had me sign the thing, Mike had said, "In here, the women's speaker." I said, "No, I'm not." Which is good, I guess, because a lot of times what happens to me when I know I'm going to speak is I run and go crazy with it, and at least hopefully, I prayed and I've asked God to let me be a messenger and to get my ego out of the way, because the women are real, real important to me. You know, it's all about what you think of me matters, you know, and that's real different. It used to be all about what do the men think of me, and you know, it's like thinking about this, I don't know. When I got in here as a newcomer, I got clean in Southern California in the Riverside area, and I was told the whole deal about not getting in a relationship for a year. And so what I did was I made friends with men around me, and I hung out a lot with the women, and I've met a whole lot of really good people. It's like Freddie, our speaker earlier today. You know, he was somebody that I had the honor of doing some service with. And, you know, it's like the guy that led the meeting, Dana, is someone that when I moved up here I met. And I've known him through service, too. And it's like a lot of my very dearest friends are people that I've done service with. And, you know, not turn stuff down. And it's like, you know, John asked me to do this a while back. And one of the early things I learned is never to say no. And today, it's like I was trying to squeeze out of this. In fact, I was like, I saw I had run into, Dana had come to my office yesterday and said, "Are you going up there?" I'm like, "Oh, kids been at the babysitter and 9 o'clock in the morning." And I really was toying with not showing up because I thought, I'm just the beginning speaker. It's no big deal. And my significant other works in Fresno, so we were up here yesterday cashing his check, and we pull into the bank, and who's at the bank but Sandra and John sitting in the car? And so it was like, "All right, God, I guess I should, and John goes, "Are you ready?" And I'm going, please, well, I'm not real sure, and I thought, yeah, okay, I'll be there, you know, I'm real glad that, and you know what, that's something that when I was brand new, my first several years, I'd never consider not showing up for something that I committed to, and so I really need to look at that, because that's something that, you know, part of what I do with my recovery, I kind of augment my recovery with a lot of tapes. Because in my particular area, there's not a whole lot of women with time. There's not a whole lot of people with time. I mean, there's a whole lot of people that have maybe 3 years. One person has 5 years. And, you know, I celebrated 7 in October. And it's like, that's about it. And so what I have to do, because I love Narcotics Anonymous, and I don't go to other fellowships. You know, I know that, yeah, if I went to other fellowships, I could find that recovery in years. But Narcotics Anonymous is in my heart, and that's where I got clean, and that's where I stay. And so what I do is I listen to tapes a whole lot, and, and that kind of fills in those gaps. And one of the things I heard a lady say recently was, "My disease is progressive, so my recovery better be too." And I was like, yeah, you know. And, you know, it's like kind of, we get clean, and my first 2 years, I was in a meeting every night but Thursdays, because I worked late on Thursdays, and sometimes I'd go and I'd hit the meeting late. And I immersed myself in Narcotics Anonymous, and it's like, I've learned a whole lot in this program. You know, Freddie talked about being judgmental and trying not to be judgmental, and that's one of the things that my God has been teaching me. You know, it's like what I find is that when I judge somebody, I end up walking in those shoes. You know, it's like I was one of those in my early recovery. After I got a year, I knew I wrote the book, and I was real good about telling you what you needed to do. And I can remember women, coming into those meetings, and they'd have kids. And my home group was a Monday night meeting, and then I'd be in a meeting Tuesday night and Wednesday night. If I didn't see those newcomers in there, and I'd see them again Wednesday or Thursday, I'd say, well, where were you, and why weren't you at the meeting, and really get in their shit. And I can remember them telling me, well, I've got kids, and I had things to do. Well, that's not an excuse. If you really wanted to be clean, and you know what, I have a child today, and it's like, I really hope someday I can run into some of those women to make amends for being the asshole that I was about, well, if you wanted to be clean, you'd be in a meeting every single night. And bottom line is that, you know, today I'm working on that balance. You know, I have a kid that's going to be 4 years old, and I've got a full-time job, and it's, you know, it's cleaning the house, huh? But, you know, it's kind of like balance is something that that I really work on today. And what I know is that, you know, I cannot be in a meeting every single night because, I've got a life today. And that doesn't mean that I wouldn't want to be. I love to go to meetings. You know, it's like I like service committee meetings. I'm one of those weirdos. And, you know, it's something that I'm real excited about Narcotics Anonymous, and it's something that has made me clean, not just drug-free, but clean on the inside. Because you know what? When I got here, for a lot of years, I felt like what Noreen had coming was I was going to OD, I was going to end up in the penitentiary, or somebody would blow me away. And that was my choices. That's what Noreen had coming for her life. And, you know, it's like I used things outside of myself to make me feel better way, way before I even found drugs. You know, people talk about feeling like they were born an addict. And I obsessed on things, and I lived in a fantasy world even when I was a real little kid. It's like I lived, my mom and I had moved out into our own place when we were about eight, when I was eight. And prior to that, I'd lived with my aunt and my uncle, and I only saw her on weekends. And so she would tell me, you know, be sure and be a good girl. Don't make any trouble. And I was like petrified about, well, what does that mean? What does being a bad kid mean? And it's like way back then I learned to walk on eggshells and people please and not say anything, you know, quote unquote, that might rock the boat. And when I was about eight, we moved into our own place, and I remember her telling me that she couldn't afford a babysitter. So her big girl wasn't going to be afraid, was she? You know, and it's like, oh, okay, no, I won't be afraid. And I'll tell you what, I distinctly remember being scared to death and leaving all of the lights on and carrying a poker around and a knife, and I was petrified, but she didn't want to hear that, and so I had to, like, live up to that expectation. And so what I did was I lived in fantasy. I'd get into this fantasy world about, I watched TV a lot, I read a lot, and I escaped through books a whole lot, and that's something that even today I have to be real careful not to immerse myself in a book, because I can check out, and I, you know, of course, I've got this little body running around my house that doesn't let me check out too much into books. But it's kind of like those same coping mechanisms that I had way back when are things that I can get into today and that I have to be careful of. And one of the things, like I said, that I did early on is, you know, I lived in a fantasy world. I didn't like the way, I know this today, a lot of what I tell you is stuff I've learned in the program and through doing inventories and through, you know, going to meetings. Back then, I wasn't aware of how I felt, you know, and so it's like I lived in a fantasy world, and I'd always pretend to be like Roy Rogers and Dale Evans, and I'd be the hero and had people around me, and the truth was I was real scared of people. It was real hard for me to make friends, and like we moved a lot, and I don't know why. My particular family, there wasn't chemical abuse in my family, but as far as dysfunctional, you better believe it. I heard a tape recently where a lady said, you know, dysfunctional families, what do we call them before we came up with that word? And she said they were fucked up families is what they were. But, you know, my family was real into, there was like three sisters, and they were the important ones, and the kids and the husbands were just kind of, we were there, but there was not any, we weren't really important. They were the dynamic. And if two of them were together, they'd bad rap the one that wasn't there, and then the other two would get together and they'd bad rap, and it was like, and then when they were all together, it was like, oh yes, we love each other, and it was like, wait a minute, you know, so trusting people was real hard for me, and being honest with people, you know, when I, even today, like when I've got something that I have to say to somebody that I perceive they may not like, it's like I really have to struggle with being real, and in fact, there's sometimes that I have to go back and say, you know, like I'll agree to do things that I don't really want to do, and I'll have to sometimes go back and say, You know, I said I'd do that, and I really didn't want to do it, but I said I would because I thought you would. You know, and it's like, and that's kind of, it feels real funny doing that. I feel real stupid doing that. But it's like, I hope that as I stay clean and as I grow, that'll get better and I can be true to myself. You know, part of what had happened to me was, at 14 years old, I got pregnant, and I'm going to be 43. And I deny about that, too. Recently, I was thinking how old I was, and I thought of a number, and I had to take, well, I was born in 1948, and I went, shit. So, but I'm going to be 43 in November, and when I got pregnant, it was 1963. And it was like, today, I mean, it happens, and today people accept it. Back then, it was like, it was a big shameful thing. And I was never able to make a whole bunch of friends. And God, we didn't talk about sex. My mom didn't talk about sex to me. It was like she told me where babies came from was that when you kissed, and to the day, to her dying day, she never said anything different, you know? And so it was like the whole issue of sex and boyfriends and all of that stuff was a real kind of clouded issue. And so I got pregnant, and we did a lot of really weird things to try to get rid of that child, you know, mustard douches, and he would hit me in the stomach, and, you know, just stuff like that. And it was like, she'll be 28 in December, so that it wasn't God's will that she wasn't going to be around. But it's something that I was real freaked out when I allowed myself to feel. But I didn't know how to deal with it. I didn't know what I was going to do. So what I did was just not think about it. And I carried that child to term, and nobody ever knew. It's like I kept that secret. Tent dresses were real popular, and I basically did not eat. And so nobody ever knew. And I can remember when President Kennedy was killed, being in English class and that coming over the loudspeaker. And at that point, the baby turning over, and it like broke through. And I went, wow, the baby moved. But then it was gone. You know, so my ability to deny what is happening in my life is real, real serious. And there's been periods of my recovery where I haven't looked at what was going on. And when I got here, I got a real good foundation. And you know, there's been times in my recovery when my program has worked me, and I haven't worked it, and I'm real grateful for that. You know, there's been times when God kept me clean because what was going on in my life was too painful for me to deal with it. And so one more time, let's not think about it, and it'll go away. And it's like, you know, I'm real grateful to be clean today, and I appreciate my recovery. You know, it's like I know people get loaded with years, you know, and that terrifies me. And it's something that, you know, it happens. And in fact, there's some women in our area that it's happened to. And it just hurts my stomach, man. And it's like, you know, and bottom line is that I don't want to be one of those. I don't want to be a statistic. And so what I know today is that I have to take my recovery real seriously. And I do, you know. And I'm real grateful. I'm real grateful that God has allowed me to be clean as long as I have, you know, and I know that I have to keep working at it. You know, that whole period of time after the kid was born, and what I found out through my first inventory is that I was a baby with a baby. You know, I was barely 15. I didn't know how to nurture myself. I didn't know how to take care of myself. But yet, boom, here's this baby, and I'm 15, and he's 17, and people said we'd get married, so we got married. And I just shut down. I mean, I just, as if I wasn't already shut down. You know, let's say I remained shut down. And at 16 years old, I was divorced with a year-old baby. And I grew up in the San Fernando Valley, and it's kind of like on date night where we went was either Van Nuys Boulevard or Hollywood. And so I would go, what I know today is that I was really lonely, and I was really searching for somebody. I had that emptiness inside of me, that hole inside of me. And so I was out cruising every single night, and my grandpa died, my mom went back to Kentucky, and I went to Hollywood and said, hey, I got this house, and boom, I had like 30 bike riders there. And by this time, you know, I had started to smoke a little bit of dope and drink some, and I loved it. It's like, gee, you know, now I have all these friends, and I'm accepted, and blah, 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 blah. And she ended up coming home early from her trip and kicked me out and made a statement about it. And if you think you're taking this kid with you, and it's like, you know what, you didn't have to say anymore. And I hit the streets hard and heavy. And I loved it. I mean, it's like I never had any concept of who Noreen was. When I got to these rooms and people said things like, feeling less than. It was like, God, yes. You know, one of the things that I loved about coming into recovery was that people were able to put into words feelings I had had that I didn't know how to describe. And I came in here and people said things, and it was like talking about doing things that, well, I did that, and they're clean, and they've got 5 years. Wow, maybe there's some hope for me. You know, and one of the things was like always feeling different, even as a little kid. I mean, I would get invited to a birthday party, and I would obsess about what should I wear and what should I buy them, and blah, 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 blah. And then I'd get there, and I always felt like they were kind of round and I was square. They knew. They had the secret. Like, they could talk to each other, and they had the words, and they seemed comfortable. And I was just, I would leave as soon as I possibly could because of how uncomfortable and how weird I felt. And, you know, I came to these rooms, and people talked about that. You know, when I started, like when I left home, I was 17 years old and went to Hollywood, and Hollywood in the mid-60s, I mean, it was like, it was heaven to me. You know, I became this little hippie dope fiend, and I used as much as I could. I ran around with people that had gone to jail and been in the penitentiary and talked about, you know, yeah, I just finished doing a bullet. And I was like, wow, what does that mean? You know, stars in my eyes. And they go, well, that means you did a year in jail. I'm like, well, I wanted to say that. I wanted to, you know, go to the penitentiary. So I guess I've got a civil brand in L.A. And all those women would say, yeah, we were up at so-and-so, an officer. They knew each other's names, and they knew the cops' names and the names of the different houses they were in. It was like, I wanted to be in on that club. And I worked at it, you know, but God saw fit that I didn't have to go that far. You know, I did end up going in and out of jail, you know, probably 20 times. I couldn't even tell you. But that was part of the story. You know, the first time I got busted was like one day, I was 18 years old. But boy, when I got out and hit the street again, yeah, I just got out of SBI, and thank God nobody asked me, well, what were you there for and how long were you there? Because I made it seem real big. And, you know, and part of what I would do was always hook up with some guy that was dealing so I could act like I was the one. You know, and yeah, what do you want? I can get it for you. And you know what? It was never me. It was always them having it. But it's like I fed off of that. And if I had somebody around me, then I was okay. You know, and it's like, you know, I sold my ass, and there's times when I didn't have any place to sleep, and so I'd pick up somebody just for a place to sleep. And, you know, it's like that period lasted about 7 years, and some of the things that you know, it's like I was in a state of demoralization, and I didn't even have a clue. I didn't even know until I got here. And one of the things in doing my first inventory that I shared with my sponsor was like, God, you know, the lengths I went to and the things I did with my body, and it didn't matter, the people, and just seedy shit, man. And it's real scary that I can allow myself to sink to that depth, you know. And it was like, well, what she shared back with me was, you know, Noreen, you were able to do that back then. You're in recovery today, and you don't ever have to allow yourself to get to that depth again. It was like, yeah, but you know what? I have to remember that I'm capable of doing that. I'm capable of living in a pile of shit and thinking it's fine and not doing what Noreen needs to do for herself. Because I've done that on a lesser degree in recovery, you know. And in like 71, I got busted for sales. Yeah, I was going to go to the penitentiary for that. I was glad. And shit, in a period of 6 weeks, I like bailed out, got busted. I picked up like 7 felonies in a period of 6 weeks. And finally they kept me. And they gave me the joint suspended in a year in the women's jail in L.A. And it was like, well, fine, okay, I got my bullet. And when I got out of there, it's like the whole time I'm in jail, so I'm writing to my mother, and she's running for me and coming to visit me. And I'm going to get out of here and go raise my daughter. And I'm going to fit this, I'm going to fit myself in that peg. I'm going to do it. And I got out, and maybe it was 3 months before I was busted again, and they did a joint, you know, I had the joint suspended, but instead they put me in a treatment facility. Unfortunately, in 1971, they said, well, you know, drugs are illegal, but it's okay to drink. And I spent a year and a half in that program. When I got out of there, of course, I began drinking, and it wasn't within a year before I was doing other drugs. Now, part of my denial was, hey, I'm not sticking a needle in my arm anymore. I'm not running the streets. I mean, sure, I have a house. I have a place to sleep, a place to take a bath. And I must not be a dope fiend anymore. I got a job. And you know, I married a guy that I met in the program because he loved me, and it was like, and he wanted to marry me, and it was like, well, okay, that's fine, that's enough. Give me somebody who wants me. And God, it was a trip. And then we like moved out together, and he started smoking dope, and so I left, and then he said he stopped, so I moved back in, and we made plans to be married. And a couple days before the wedding, he goes, oh, and by the way, I started smoking dope again. And you know, for an instant, I thought about, well, then I can't marry you. But it's like, hey, I was going to be married, you know, and that meant I was going to be okay. So what did I do? I started smoking dope with him and doing other chemicals. And it was like that one lasted about 3 years. I frequently say my manalog is about as long as my drug-a-log, you know, because it was always had to be with somebody. And now I've been married 4.5 times, the last one I divorced because he was using, and I swore never again. I don't know how many times in meetings that I said, no way, and people would say, you think you guys will get back together? No way, you know, and so what I have to try to do today is never say never, you know, because we are together today, and he's clean again, and it's okay, you know, and there was a whole lot of ego tied up in that, too, like, God, I talked so bad about him, and I said, no way, son of a bitch, and blah, 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 you know, and so at first, he had moved into the house, like, on a roommate basis, and I was keeping secrets. I didn't even want people to know he was there. And then we started like just doing things as a family on a friendship basis, and we got to know each other again, and it was like, okay, but I'll tell you what, it was like real, and thank God for the meetings of Narcotics Anonymous, because I went to a meeting, and I was sharing, and a lot of the people that had supported me when he was loaded, and that I said, never again, were in there, and God allowed me to realize that what I was feeling was embarrassed, and I said to them, you know what? Yeah, we're back together, and I'm real embarrassed. And it was like by saying it that it was okay, and it was gone, and it was released. And that's one of the things that I was taught in this program that I didn't always listen to. You know, it's like that whole, you know, on and on and on. And it's like I married my third husband, and he had it was one of those, we met July 4th, and we're married by August. You know, that's another one of my patterns. And he had a brother who was dealing speed in San Diego, and it was like that was the beginning of the end. You know, the last year and a half of my use, it was like daily use. And by then, I'd gotten a job as a drug counselor, and I was going to work loaded. I'd stay up all night and party, and then go to work loaded with these, you know, saucer eyes, and not be able to look my clients in the eye because they'd know I was loaded. And you know, I had this mirror up on the wall, and I can remember looking in that mirror going, what are you doing? What in the hell are you doing? And, you know, and God sent a whole lot of Eskimos out for me. It seems like it was real obvious that I was blowing it at work. I was not going to, I'd miss, you know, a couple of days, or I'd come in 2 hours late, and they'd be mad at me, and I couldn't understand why. Well, I'm here. I mean, I'm gracing you with my presence, and they started doing this memo trail on me, and with good reason, man. I was blowing it. And I remember one time one of the supervisors coming to me and saying, Noreen, because he's a guy I'd gotten loaded with, and he wasn't an addict. He goes, Noreen, people are telling me you're coming to work loaded. And I'm like, pissed. Well, who's saying this? And I'm going to go tell them. And it didn't even dawn on me. The reason they were saying that was because it was true. It was all about that other people. They're talking about me. They're trying to get me in trouble. Look what they are doing. And it's his fault and everybody else's fault. You know, and one of the things I heard in some of my first meetings was about blame, that we blame other people. I went, shit, I sure do. And today when I'm in a blame mode and I'm looking at all of you guys and oh, this one and that one, I really have to look at, all right, so where are you? What's happening with you that you got to be critical of other people? Because when I get real critical of you, there's something going on with me and I have to kind of turn it inward. Narcotics Anonymous started in Riverside in 1983, and I used to tell the story that our director told all the counselors to go to give the meeting support because our clients needed it, and as I got clean and a little bit clear, I thought, well, now wait a minute, it was me and one other guy, you know, but I used to think it was all of us, and me and this other guy, yeah, selective memory, me and this other guy used to go, and I was loaded. I mean, I was speeding, and I'd go there, and I'd tell him, yep, I used to be an addict, and now I'm an alcoholic, because by now I had to cop to something, because obviously something was going on, and they were, like, memoing me at work, and I couldn't, if I was not going to come in, I had to have a doctor's excuse, and blah, blah, and they were being so mean to me. Funny thing, after I got clean, they weren't so mean, you know? But I was really blowing it, and like God was sending lots of messengers out for me. It seems like every time I turned around, somebody was talking about recovery, and it really was pissing me off. I mean, there was this lady at work, and she, you know, said, why don't you come to a meeting with us, Noreen? And then I'd run in, I'd go do a thing for work, and I finally allowed that I'd go to one meeting, get to get these people off my back, and it was like I sat there like this, and God, it was painful, and I, of course, was wondering why, what am I doing here with all these seedy people, you know? And, but funny thing, I heard things I related to, you know, and, it was probably 8-9 months before I made it to another meeting, and then I went because I knew I needed to be there. But, you know, the people of Narcotics Anonymous were real kind to me now because I was loaded and was talking out my ass, and, they just kind of chuckled. I bet they chuckled a lot more later than they did to my face, but, and they just said, keep coming back, Noreen. It'll get better. And, you know, and I was going to meetings, and it's like my life was really, I was really hitting a bottom. But you know what? I'm real glad, because my God allowed me to beat my head against that wall and beat my head against that wall for a long time before it was like, you know what? This ain't working. And, you know, being powerless over my addiction, it's like, I would use, and my heart would go, and I think, I'm going to die. But the minute that would settle down, as long as there was drugs there, I'd use more, you know. And it's like when I got here and talked about being powerless over my addiction, it was like, yeah, boy, I got that one real quick. And, you know, coming to believe that, you know, God could relieve me of this insanity, it was like, you know, so many times I was out there and I would be in a blackout for days. And yet I'd still come to, you know. I'd be driving a car and come to in a whole other community and not know how I got there. You know, somebody was taking care of me. You know, so when I got here and heard about that, you know, God was there and that God could relieve us of this addiction, it's like, yeah, I could buy that real easy, you know. And I wanted what you guys had. It's like I heard people talk about being worse than me and they were clean today. And they could talk to each other, you know. Whew. I hate it the first little bit. It's like I was so uncomfortable, and I'd go to meetings, and I'd kind of stare at the speaker, and I was out there. And then there'd be a coffee break, and I'd, oh, God, I hated that, because I didn't know what to do with myself. And I'd go in the bathroom for a while, and then I'd straighten the literature, and then it was like, God, hurry up. And, of course, it had nothing to do with I was loaded. You know, and it's like I would be thinking, I cannot use before I go to work, and I cannot use before I go to this meeting. And the best that I could do was to do a little. And think you guys won't know. I thought, oh, they really won't know. I'll just use a little. And, you know, and it's like my husband at the time was coming back with like 17 ounces, and I left that night because I knew as long as there was drugs in the house, I'd use whatever was there, and I knew I'd die, you know. And I immersed myself in the program. And it's something that the things that I learned early on are things that have carried me today. You know, like I mentioned, you know, I got clean in Southern California. I moved up here almost 4 years ago. And when I moved up here, it was real different because down there it was all about, Noreen, it was important. They knew who I was, you know. And I'm, you know, it's like I was one of the few women that had over a year, so I was sponsoring lots of people, and I'd go to a meeting, and they'd always call on me. And then I came up here, and it's all about, okay, so who are you, and you've got how much time, and prove it. They didn't say prove it, but that was the attitude. And so what I did was get involved in service, you know, and one more time, service carried me. Service allowed me to have that modality to talk to people about, because that fear and that, you know, low self-esteem kicks right in, and I was able to become, feel a part of. And what had happened was the guy I moved up here with, we'd been married like a year, maybe 2 years, and it was going to be Mr. and Mrs. N.A., and, you know, all the way. Happily ever after, and he ended up having an operation and started using prescription drugs. And I can remember, you know, when I talked to you about having shit go on in your life and not dealing with it, that period of time where I'd wake up and he would have been up all night, And it was just, the feeling was just like the old days, man. People been partying all night, and I'm just, you know, I'm getting up to go to work, and it just, it felt shitty. But I didn't talk about it, you know. It was all about, part of that was protectiveness, part of that was shame, and part of that was that whole thing is, I'm clean. And if he's using in my house, one and one means he gotta go, and this was my fourth marriage, man, and this was supposed to last. So what I did was stuff it, and not talk about it, and go to meetings, and talk about the book, and talk about what you need to do, and I talked good shit. But I was dying inside, you know? I mean, I could save you, but I was dying inside. And, you know, thank God for, you know, God put some people in my life. There was a lady at work that I could talk to what was real. And then there was a couple people from Porterville that knew what was going on. I can remember this one woman. I was at a picnic, and this has been going on for about a year, and he was steadily getting worse. And at this picnic, she says, Noreen, how are you? And I was kind of, yeah, it's okay, and that false smile, and she looked me in the face, she says, God damn it, would you get fucking real? And I started to cry, and she said, thank you. And it's like, you know what, that woman, you know, she wasn't there to hurt me, she was there to save my goddamn life. And it's like I had to be pushed up against the wall one more time, and I read this thing about, these are the symptoms of relapse, and I went, shit. All right, Miss Ego, you too could get loaded, and you too better get up off your ass and start doing some things for your recovery. And so I started talking about what was going on in my life in meetings. And, you know, he ended up one morning just before Christmas, not this Christmas, Christmas a year ago, he was going to go into the recovery hospital, and I got up that morning, and he was passed out on the bathroom floor with the rig in his arm. And it was like, you know those Roadrunner cartoons where the Roadrunner gets hit with the brick and his eyes go bloop and they're all bloodshot? That's what his eyes looked like. And he was like going, and then nothing. And then nothing. I kept opening the door. Well, he's still breathing and shutting the door. And I mean, I was a bit on the edge, you know. I was a bit on the edge. And it was like, I kept thinking, you know, I'm going to go to work and he might die. And part of me, you know what, I had been praying to God to take him. I had been praying, you know, God, just take this one and I'll do better next time. And there's insurance, you know, I'll remove him from my life. And it was real scary, you know, and it's like that period of time, I'll tell you what, I didn't have much of a conscious contact, but I did continue to pray. But a lot of times it was real desperate and it was real, what do you want from me and why is this happening to me? Please fix it. And I waited a long time for God to fix it, God to fix it. And finally, like I said, it just came to the, you know, up against the wall, and I had to do some shit. I had to do some footwork. And I ended up that day calling the hospital and saying, well, he was supposed to check in, but he's passed out in the bathroom. I don't think he's going to make it. And they said, well, something about have someone watch him. And I went, I've got to go to work. He's going to be here by himself. And I remember later, God, I bet they thought I was a cold-hearted bitch. But, you know, I had just, I had had it, and he did check into that hospital, and was going to leave the next day, and I went to the hospital prepared with, you know, some of the things that we learn on the streets can be useful later. I'll tell you what, before I went to that hospital, I went home, and in like half hour, I had my car packed with work clothes play clothes and toys for my kid and enough to do me for 2 weeks, you know, and I was ready to book, and sure enough, when they threw him out of that hospital, I booked, and some people in the program took me in, and a whole lot of people in this program. That's one of the things that, you know, we don't ever, ever have to do any of this stuff alone. And a lot of times, my isolation and my ego and my, hey, I'll help you, but God forbid I ask for help, is a killer. You know, I consistently have to, like, kick it out and make myself ask for help and make myself tell you know what? I hurt, and I'm lonely, and this is what's happening. And, you know, since this, I really got in touch with that whole year and a half. I stayed clean because God graced me. I stayed clean because God wanted me to stay clean. I was not participating in my own recovery. And today, when I'm in a meeting, and I've got some shit going on, I will say it. I get in that ego thing, oh, you've got, you know, counting, taking your pulse, I've got this much time, I should be as shit. You know, it's like we are where we are, and we need to talk about what we need to talk about. And I do pretty good about, I don't do real good about not thinking, oh, what are they thinking, but I do pretty good about sharing what I need to share for me and not, you know, for what looks good to my ego or whatever, because I don't want to go out there, you know, and it's been the women in the program who have been there for me and saved my ass, you know, and I'm real grateful to be clean today. You know, he had a year in March, and like I said, we've been back together, and I'm in no hurry to get married again, so I've got 2, 4 and a half husbands. But, you know, it's like whatever God wants for me, you know, and I know what he wants for me is for me to stay clean and for me to have a good life. And if I participate in my recovery and work my steps and talk with my sponsor and be honest with you guys, then that's what's going to happen. And I want to thank you very much for letting me share. It's been a real honor.
Got my format all wet.
Oh, our next speaker is from the area where I'm clean from, and I've only known her for a short time, but she usually has some really good stuff to share, so would you please welcome Lori.
My name's Lori, and I'm an addict. Feels naked up here. Thanks for sharing, Irene. That was really, I related to a lot of the things that you were saying. One of the things that gets awkward at times, especially when I share at the same meeting as somebody else who has a much different background than I, is that there's differences, you know. And I can't share with you that I had years and years of using and years of different drugs, because I didn't. I got clean when I was 13, and how much can you use before you're 13? But one of the things that I have learned, and I've heard it shared by you and also with Freddie today, is that you know what, this disease is progressive, and whether or not I'm using, it still is there, alive, and progressing. And I have hit a greater bottom clean than I did, you know, to get me clean. So I can't share with you a long period, so I won't even try. When I got clean, like I said, I was 13. I turned 14 while I was in treatment. And how I ended up there was my parents decided that my behavior was very inappropriate and they were intolerant of it. So that was, I got clean in Minnesota. That's where I grew up. And at that time, it was very fashionable to go through treatment. It was the thing that everybody was doing, the new up-and-coming thing or something. So anyway, they got intolerant of my behavior, and they threw me in treatment, and I didn't think that I had a problem with drugs, you know. My problem was my parents. My problem was the teachers at school, and I wasn't as bad as you people were, you know. I wasn't as bad as anybody. I was just somebody who liked to use. The people that I hung around with were people who robbed houses and you know, ripped off cars and, you know, those kinds of things. And I didn't do that. I just hung out with them and got the benefits of their crime. So to me, I didn't have a problem. You know, I did not want to look at the pain that I was feeling. You know, I didn't want to take a look at the things that I was doing, you know, where they were at was just around the corner. You know, I liked what they were doing. I wanted to be like them. I just was too scared to actually make the effort to do it. So when I got a point of treatment, you know, I thought it was a joke. It was like, okay, I'll tell you what you want to hear and, you know, kiss your ass a little bit and I'll get out. I lied about how much I used. And they still thought that I needed to complete their treatment program and stay clean. And looking back on that then, given all the time that I've been clean,
You know, I was a petrified, lonely, scared little girl. And if you would have told me that I was going to walk through the things that I have walked through in my life so far, I would have killed myself, plain and simple. Because I did not have any idea that people could survive the feelings that I had was feeling, you know. So anyway, I BS'd my way for about 3 weeks. Did what they told me to do and did as little as possible. And when it came time to about a week before I left this hospital, my parents told me that if I chose to use when I got out, that they were going to lock me up for a year. I was only one of them 30-day quick programs. And the thought of that petrified me. I did not want to be locked up. So I made a decision to not use. I didn't go to meetings. I didn't really have any friends, you know. The things that they told me in treatment were, you don't go back to your old friends. You don't hang out with people who use because then you'll get loaded. So I isolated. I had no friends. My cousin, who I did use with, who's not an addict, when I got clean, she got clean. She stopped using. And her and I became best friends. But that's all I had. You know, I went to school and I was terrified. I didn't talk to people. You know, I hid in the bathrooms in between classes. Because I didn't know how to communicate with people clean. It was just too scary. And I went to meetings occasionally. They didn't have Narcotics Anonymous meetings then, and so I went to whatever kind of meetings there were. And I didn't feel a part of. I didn't feel like I fit in. So I winged it. To be honest with you, I have no idea why I stayed clean, because I was so miserable. Other than fear of being put into another place and being locked up for a year. When I had about a year and a half clean, this guy who I went to school with decided he was clean, decided to get clean. And him and I started hanging out a little bit, and I got a taste of what it was like to be with another recovering addict, you know. I didn't like him, but he was all I had. I remember we used to fight all the time, but I had somebody. I had somebody that I could relate to. I started going to and starting support groups for teenagers that were trying to stay clean, and I met a few people that way. But I wasn't going to meetings. You know, it was the therapy kind of stuff or the counseling kind of stuff, and there still was that void that I felt. But it got me a few friends and it got me a little bit of self-esteem. When I had, I guess it was a little bit later than that, a girlfriend of mine from school got clean and she called me up and she said, you know what, I'm going to go to this meeting. Do you want to go? So I went with her. And it was a young people's meeting. And because I had someone like to hold my hand, I went. And I found out that there were people like me who were trying to do the same thing. You know, they were working steps in their lives, which is something I had no concept of. You know, I had to do step 1 through 5 to get out of treatment and in 30 days or less. And I started making friends, and I started doing things that were fun, you know. Things that I never thought that I was going to do, you know. I never thought I was a person that had an ego. You know, I didn't think I was grandiose or arrogant in any way. I am. It's a painful process to find that out, but it's true. But we started doing lame things like going bowling, you know. And we had fun. I started going to dances. I still don't dance, but I go to dances. And I started to understand a little bit about the fellowship part of this program and having people be there. And I went to meetings. I started going to meetings on a regular basis. When I had about 3 years clean, or almost 3 years clean, this guy had started going to these Narcotics Anonymous meetings. Now, I grew up in suburbia,
Minneapolis. I don't think I had been into the actual city of Minneapolis, but five times, you know, other than my treatment center was there. But anyway, it petrified me. I was a naive little kid. At this time, I think I had just gotten my driver's license. So I went to this Narcotics Anonymous meeting with this guy. And I walked in to this meeting. It was in this horrid part of downtown, or actually uptown. But anyway, I walked up these stairs. The room's like dark. And there's this guy standing there, this big. Okay, he's got Harley everything. Harley belt buckle, Harley shirt, Harley this, Harley, even had a Harley thing on his glasses. And he walks up and gives me a hug and says, "Hi, my name's Fish. Welcome to the Wednesday night meeting." And I just thought, what in the hell am I doing here? I mean, I was this little kid. I thought this guy was going to rape me, you know? And I stayed, you know, thank God that meeting was a candlelight meeting, because after going, I made a decision to continue to go. I don't know why. I certainly didn't think that I belonged in these meetings. You guys used narcotics. I didn't. You guys did things that I didn't do, and I was real into looking at the differences and not the similarities. But I kept going back to that meeting. And it took me probably about 6 months to peel myself off the wall and sit towards the middle of the room or say hello to anybody. But I kept going, you know, and people noticed me. People noticed, you know, "Glory, come on, come to coffee with us." I'm like, no, I have things to do, you know, and I didn't. I would cry on the way home because I was so lonely. But I kept going back, and finally I started doing things like picking up ashtrays and staying 5 minutes after the meeting was over, you know, coming 2 minutes early, doing those things. During the coffee break, I didn't go to the bathroom. You know, I never had to pee anyway. I just hid. I stood in line, so I had something to do. Because I was so afraid to talk to you people. But this meeting was a candlelight meeting, and because of that, being in an intimate setting like that, and the room being dark, you couldn't see how red my face got when I shared. So I was comfortable. And I started to open up, and I started to talk. I think it was a year or two later than that, the basic text came out, and they started having a book study meeting. And I started to hear a little bit about what the steps were. You know, I didn't have a sponsor, because it took me so long to finally make it to Narcotics Anonymous. I had more clean time than most of the people in the rooms, and I had more clean time than any women that I knew. Which was real difficult. Being 17 and having the most clean time in the room is, and being as scared as I was, I didn't feel like I could reach out to people and be honest about what was going on. You know, I was real afraid, you know, like you were sharing, to let people know who I was and what was really happening. So I made a decision to get a sponsor. I called up a helpline for another 12-step program and asked them, "Do you know anybody who is young and has a lot of time clean, because I need a sponsor?" And the lady who answered the phone said, "You know what, we don't have anything to help you, but I do know somebody, and I'll give you her number." And even as a weak attempt or whatever it felt to me, I wanted what you guys had. I wanted some of the things that I saw. I wanted to be better, but I didn't know how to go about doing it. So I got a sponsor, and I started working the steps a little bit. I started to open up. I started to trust people. I started being of service. You know, I went to a women's meeting in a women's jail. I started picking up people for the meeting, so I'd have to, like, stay, you know. I started going out to coffee after the meeting, and I started to feel good. Along in this, I also found men. They'd always been there.
And I really believe that I switched my active addiction to meeting men. It was very important to me that I get that attention from men, which is a long history of things, but I was raped when I was 9 by my cousin, and I didn't have a very tight relationship with my father growing up, and as a result, I learned, you know, my equation, that if somebody wanted to have sex with me, that meant they loved me and I was worthwhile. And that's what I knew how to do, you know. So I went from, you know, I needed to have somebody there. And the men that I chose were not the best of men. And I got into this relationship with this guy, and at 21 he was a virgin, and I should have known better that was not for me. But anyway, we were not compatible. That's all I'm trying to say. I mean, he's a nice guy. But anyway, we were not compatible. And he did not fix that need for me. He did not want to have sex with me constantly. Therefore, I did not feel complete. So after back and forth of him, I stepped out on him. I had an affair with this guy for 6 months. And he never knew it. You know, and I thought that I was getting over and things were great. You know, I had this guy who loved me, who wanted to give me everything. He just wouldn't have sex with me, so I had this other guy I'd have sex with. And he bought me flowers and left little secret notes on my car and did all those kinds of things. And as far as I was concerned, I was complete. You know, I didn't think about what I was doing to myself. I didn't think about how much I was hurting this guy that I really loved and cared about. I just did what I needed to do and was very selfish. So him and I ended up, the guilt got the better of me, and I told him what I was doing, and he broke up with me. And I started to hit an emotional bottom, you know. I started to realize that I couldn't do the things that I was doing and stay clean. You know, living the dishonest lifestyle that I was living, doing those kinds of things. You know, no, I wasn't still ripping off people when I first got clean. I didn't stop stealing. It took me 2-3 years to do that. I had a job being a volunteer at the YMCA, and I used to steal money from them. You know, so that kind of stuff stopped. But inside, emotionally, you know, I couldn't do that. The pain was too great, and I couldn't talk to people about how I felt. As a result, I had 5 years clean, and I was going to blow my brains out. The guy that I was had as a roommate at the time, I knew he had a gun, and I remember one night sitting on my bed, and I was like, you know what, I can't do this. I cannot live with this pain. It's just too much. And I started crying. I started, you know, I got hysterical, and thank God I was hysterical, because I was too flipped out to even get off my bed. And I just kept praying over and over, please, I do not want to live this way. You know, I didn't really have a good relationship with my higher power. It wasn't a conscious contact on a daily basis. But I did believe in a God, and I believe that I didn't come that far to have it end that way. And the only thought that came to my mind that night was, I could not kill myself and have my roommate walk in and find me. And that's the only reason I didn't do it. Had nothing to do with me, had nothing to do with wanting better for myself or deserving better for myself. You know, and I'm really grateful that thought came to me, because I'm still here. But I decided that I needed something else, you know, that things weren't working. So I tried therapy. And I went to this therapist, and you know, I got a lot of good things from her. In the hour a week that I saw her was really good. But it was like, okay, this is an hour a week. What are you going to do with the rest of your week? And it was like, hello, Narcotics Anonymous. You go to these meetings. That's what they're there for. You know, you have steps. Work them in your life. And that's what I made the decision to do. You know, I dove into taking care of Lori and doing some good things for myself.
when I had 7 years clean, I won't get into the details because I don't even know them, I ended up in California. And coming here and moving here for 7 years clean, not knowing anybody, having to start all over again, was horrible. I felt, because I didn't, you know, after going to meetings for a while, I had seen people that had the same sponsor since they first got clean. You know, they talked about working steps since they had, you know, X amount of days clean. And I once again felt less than. I did not feel like I could live up to you guys. So I reverted back to my old ways and kind of hid in the corner. And if anybody would ask me how much clean time I would have, I'd kind of go, 7 years. You know, and because I thought that at 7 years I had to have something different than what I had, you know. I'm grateful today that that didn't last long. I made a decision to get a sponsor right away. I got a sponsor. And I started developing a relationship with her that I had never developed before, you know. I made the decision that I had to have at least one person in my life that knew what was going on with me. And I'm real grateful that she was a part of my life because I don't know what I would have done without her. But once again, I wasn't that well, and I got into another relationship. On our first date, he had 29 days clean. And I don't know at all what possessed me today. I mean, I don't know what possessed me to go out with this man. He was not my type. I knew better than to go out with somebody who was barely clean. But I was insecure, and I said, fuck it, you know. I needed somebody. He was going to be my knight in shining armor and sweep me off my feet, you know. And that's not at all what happened. It was an extremely abusive relationship that I stayed in for 2.5 years, you know. And like you, I did not talk about the pain that I was in. I did not share with anybody. We had the kind of house that when you walked into, you kind of went, wow, you know, all the furniture matched. We had awesome paintings and pictures on the wall. Everything was always clean. You know, we looked good on the outside. Together, we looked good. We went through painstaking processes to look good when we walked out of the house. But I was dying. And I did not know how to tell anybody, you know. And a few people that happened to see us interact would say something to me, and I couldn't bring myself to look at it because it was much too painful. I made conscious decisions on a daily basis to compromise everything that I believed in to stay with this man because I was so afraid of being alone. And I still, today, am paying a price for that relationship. You know, I would love to say that, you know, for my ego, that I could just walk away from it and not have to feel the pain. But that's not true. Through a course of painstaking events, that relationship ended, and I started to once again catch a glimpse of the freedom that I could have by working this program, you know, by working the steps and applying the spiritual principles that are here in my life. And that meant that I don't compromise myself, you know, that I don't stay with somebody that's abusive. And there's a whole lot of freedom in that. And that may seem, overall general life, something really tiny, but it was something that I'd never made a decision to do. A year ago, I hooked up with this new man that I'm with today. And the one thing that I've always wanted to do in life is get married and have babies. You know, people say, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I want to be a mom. That's all I've ever wanted to do. And I met this guy. He has a daughter. Wants to be married. He wants to be in a relationship. He wants to have kids. And this is it. I'm happy. Life's wonderful. You know, I'm getting exactly what I wanted. I'm not forcing him to be something he doesn't want to be. This is going to be wonderful. I made the decision to get pregnant. I got pregnant. And at 12 weeks, I lost the baby, 12 weeks pregnant, and I did not think that I was going to be able to walk through that. You know, since I was 13 years old, I wanted to have a baby, and I finally was pregnant. You know, I was just starting to get past the horrid hormonal stage. I was just starting to show, and it was gone, you know, and all of my illusions of who Lori was and what I was going to be was shattered, you know, on top of the fact of dealing with the loss of a life. And I didn't think that I was going to be able to walk through that, and I did, you know. There's women in this program who've gone through similar things, you know, and they were there for me and they shared with me. Women who didn't go through those things said, I don't know what to do, I don't understand, but if you need me, I'll hug you and you can cry and I will hold you and I'll be there for you. And I walked through it. You know, I didn't think, you know, if you would have told me 2 years ago or even a year ago that I was going to be able to walk through things like that and stay clean and not have to go through the process of being suicidal before I make the decision to come back out of it, I would not have believed you. You know, that whole time and dealing with the grief of that loss, I never once wanted to die. It's been a long time since I've had the feelings of wanting to die. And that alone, besides staying clean, is the biggest miracle that could ever happen in my life. You know, since I've been clean, you know, I don't think, I mean, sometimes I think about using, but my obsession to use was lifted a long, long time ago. And my first thought is, fuck it, I'll just die. And someone said to me, Lori, you know what, that is the most self-centered, arrogant thing that anybody could say or want to do. And I was so angry when someone said that to me. It was like, what do you mean? And it's the biggest cop-out, you know. And I realized that there's far more to life than being that miserable, you know. Yeah, life happens, and dealing with life things sometimes really sucks, and it's painful. But I can choose to make it as miserable and horrid as I want to. You know, living with this little girl, my boyfriend's daughter, has been a lesson that I never wanted. You know, I had this illusion of, because I want to have kids, you know, I got pregnant and life is going to be just ducky, you know, I'm going to be a great mom, she's going to move in with us, and she was the child from hell, you know. This little girl moves in who's 8 years old and who's never had a stable, you know, living situation in her life. You know, she's got two parents who are addicts. Her mother's in jail. She's still using, and she's out there, and she's a very emotionally damaged little girl. And the lessons that I have learned about self-acceptance of others for being exactly where they are, you know, the selfless things that I have to do, the love, the unconditional love that I have to give this little girl on a daily basis sometimes is so overwhelming. And I just, there's days that I think, I cannot do this. I cannot love this little girl. It's too much work. And what am I going to get out of it? You know, she's going to be a teenager pretty soon, and she's going to really treat me like shit. You know, I mean, that's the way my head works, you know. No gratitude. And I got to say that in the past year, that has changed. Her and I have moments that are really, really nice and very special. You know, we have our bad moments. But I did not think that I was ever going to be able to say that I love this little girl and feel it, you know. And I do, you know. And I don't know when I'm going to get pregnant again, and I don't know all of that kind of stuff. But I also know that she is in my life right now, and I need to, you know, stop and deal with what's at hand instead of trying to create more things. And that's what I do, you know. If it's not happening here, if it's not going the way I want it, I'll go over here and start something else. And if that doesn't work, I'll go over here and start something else. And I changed sponsors, I don't know how many months ago, which was one of the best decisions I ever made in my life. And the thing that this woman keeps telling me over and over and over again is, you know,
how much I am going to cheat myself of the good times that I can have right now and the special moments that I can have in my life right now by trying to get something else, you know. And in that relationship, it's very true. In the relationship that I'm in right now, it's been difficult. It's difficult living with another addict, you know, that's recovering. This disease sucks, plain and simple. And I'm powerless, you know, and living with another addict brings up things, situations that I don't want to deal with. And I've had to make a choice real recently. This last month has been very, very difficult for me in this relationship. And once again, having to make decisions based on, you know, what's best for Lori and what do I want out of life and what's okay and what's not okay. And I want to please you, you know, I want to look good. I get embarrassed to say, you know, I'm in this situation or whatever. And the bottom line is, today, right now, I'm not in denial. I talk to my sponsor every day. You know, I stay in contact with her. She knows what's going on with me. And I am doing the best that I can do. And I feel good about where I'm at. It's when I get into, you say something, well, you know, what about this? And I go, well, and I want to please you, and I want to say, oh, well, you know, and whatever. I have made a decision today, and I feel really good about it, that I am okay with where I'm at. I have lessons to learn in the relationship that I'm in the job that I'm in, you know, and where I'm at in my life. And, you know, if you don't think that that's where I should be at 13 years clean, stay clean for 13 years and then tell me what it's like. and that sounds really shitty, but that's where I'm at today, because I'm really tired of having to please you people so that I can feel good, because it does not make me feel good. And I'm trying real hard not to judge other people, because it hurts when you judge me. And that's the best that I can do, you know. But I feel good. I feel really good about where my life is at, you know. I don't have the house. I don't have the kids. I don't have the white picket fence. I have a new car. but it's not everything that I wanted, but I'm okay. And it doesn't have to do with the outside things. It has to do with me, and that I have a loving God in my life. I have a sponsor that I talk to, you know. I have a program that I work, and I have friends that I love and that love me. And I never would have expected me to feel the way that I feel today. And that's a miracle. Anyway, thank you for letting me share.